Tonight I want to talk about the Gospel of Mark, something that's been laid upon my heart for the last, good year and a half, is this message of Mark's Gospel. And I've never actually ever had a chance to go over it with people. And it's not a sermon per se. We are going to do some sharing. You can shout out some answers. I'm going to ask some questions just in the same format as Brian has and Jill has on these Wednesday night services. But it does have a point and a purpose. We're going to drive right through Mark's Gospel, all 16 chapters, and hopefully be done before we can get our kids out by, 8:15 or so. So we have 45 minutes to push right through this, okay? The interesting thing about Mark's Gospel is that it's often overlooked. We know that four Gospels all have unique and distinct messages, but most often people turn to Matthew's Gospel or Luke's Gospel or John's Gospel, and Mark, because it's so short, 16 chapters, people just overlook it. And it's not just because it's short. 90% of all of Mark's stories can be found in Matthew's Gospel, and 40% of all Mark's stories can be found in Luke's Gospel. So if you just read Matthew and Luke, you pretty much got Mark. And so there's really just kind of this, after you read Matthew and you go to Mark, you're kind of like, oh, I've been there, done that. You know, it's kind of, might as well just go right to Luke. And so there's a tendency for us to overlook this small book. But the interesting thing is that Mark was most likely the first gospel written. And there's a number of reasons for that, and I don't have time to go on this, but Mark was the first person to actually sit down and write an account of Christ's life. And most likely, Matthew and Luke borrow from Mark, and that's why they have so much in common. Because Mark is overlooked, I want to focus on a few questions. There are some things in Mark that do not appear in Matthew or Luke or John. And I want to focus on these things tonight, these unique things about Mark that make up Mark's distinctive qualities, Mark's message. And there's five questions I want to ask tonight, five questions that I think every first-time reader might be puzzled by. Okay? And we're going to start from the end and work towards the beginning. Starting with chapter 16, verse 8. We're going to start there, okay? Mark chapter 16, verse 8. This may come as a surprise, but if you have an NIV or an NASB, or pretty much any other translation besides the New King James or the King James Version, you're going to have a line or some indication saying, after verse 8, that this is most likely where Mark ends. The earliest manuscripts do not contain verses 9 on down through 20. In fact, some translations will even include another alternate ending, such as my Bible does, another alternate ending that's not verses 9 through 20. Most likely, Mark did end at 16:8. The question that becomes troubling is, why does he end at chapter 16, verse 8? They've just seen the angel that has appeared to them, and he tells them that Jesus is risen, and he's going to meet them there. And in verse 8, it says, they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had gripped them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. The end. Great ending, right? Happy ending. Why does Mark end on such a sour note? Or is it a sour note? Or is there something locked within this passage that holds something more? That's question one. The second question is a little bit earlier than that. We see that the angel tells them in verse 7 to the women, but go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you to Galilee, and there you will see him just as he told you. Why does Jesus want them to return to Galilee? The third question, again, a little bit farther forward, chapter 14. Chapter 14, verse 51. This is in the Garden of Gethsemane, immediately after the disciples have fled. And it says in verse 51, a young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen sheet over his naked body. And they seized him, but he pulled free of the linen sheet and escaped naked. Why is he there? Why does Mark tell us this story? Now, there has been some speculation. Some people would say that this is Mark himself. Well, the author doesn't tell us that. And if he doesn't tell us that, then there might be another reason or another explanation for why Mark puts this story here. And we're going to ask that. Why is this story here? Moving back a little further, Mark chapter 10, verse 40. Verse 40 appears in the midst of John and James coming to Jesus and saying, Lord, we want you to do whatever we ask of you. And Jesus says, okay, go ahead and ask. And they say, grant that one of us sits on your right and on your left when you enter your glory. And Jesus goes on to say some things, but he ultimately says in verse 40, but to sit on my right and on my left, this is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared. This question I want to ask is, for whom has it been prepared? If it's not James and John, who has this place been prepared, the right and left side of Jesus in his glory? Okay, that's the fourth question. Let's go back a little bit farther and we'll go to our fifth and final question for tonight. Chapter 8, verse 22. This is another strange occurrence. It only appears in the Gospel of Mark. It doesn't appear in Matthew, Luke, or John. Here's the story. And they came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to Jesus and implored him to touch him. Taking the blind man by the hand, he brought him out of the village, and after spitting on his eyes and laying his hands on him, he asked him, do you see anything? And he looked up and said, I see men, for I see them like trees walking around. Then again he laid his hands on his eyes, and he looked intently and was restored and began to see everything clearly. Okay, besides the spit, which is odd enough, the one unique thing here that is not found anyplace else is a two-part healing of any person in the Gospels. That Jesus has to heal somebody once, and then he heals them a second time. Why? Does he not have the power to heal once? Why does he take a second time? Now, there are explanations, certainly applicable explanations for our own healing. But in Mark's gospel, the situation of the story, is there a purpose and a point for why this story is located here in chapter 8? So I'm going to try and link all of these questions, all of these scenes, these odd, strange occurrences in Mark's gospel, these things that you may have not thought were questions to ask before. Or maybe you've asked them before and came up with an explanation on your own. I'm going to give perhaps a unique explanation and try and explain Mark's gospel or the message of Mark's gospel through these stories. Let's start out in chapter 1. As I said, Mark's gospel is the shortest gospel. Mark talks about Jesus' teaching far more than Matthew does and Luke does. Mark is constantly saying Jesus was teaching, but he rarely describes what Jesus was saying. He merely briefly talks about Jesus' teaching. He doesn't quote Jesus like Matthew does in the Sermon on the Mount. Editing out all of Jesus' teaching, the pace of Mark quickens very rapidly. So this story that Mark tells is very quick, very rapid, like I said, and in this quick story, Mark focuses on a few things. And the number one thing he focuses in on is what? He focuses on Jesus, but not just on Jesus. The other counterpart to Jesus is he focuses on the disciples' relationship to Jesus. Mark describes the relationship to Jesus and his disciples as a journey. And this journey starts out in chapter 1, verse 2, with the prophecy of Isaiah. As it is written in Isaiah the prophet, behold, I send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, make ready the way of the Lord. Make his paths straight. So three times in this opening quotation from the prophet Isaiah, we see the way, the path. Mark's going to describe the way of the Lord, what that way entails. Early on in the book of Acts, you're going to find that before Christians were called Christians, they were followers of the way. That was what Christianity was called before they were called Christians. They were followers of the way. And we'll see other places in the New Testament where this idea of the way is illustrated, such as Hebrews chapter 12. So Jesus sets out on this way, and on his way, he calls these disciples. And immediately he calls these disciples, the first thing he does after he gets done being baptized by John in the Jordan. He goes out and is tempted by Satan, and he returns to Galilee and begins to preach, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And he goes along by the Sea of Galilee, verse 16. And as he was going along by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting a net in the sea, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, what? Follow me. So follow me in my path. Follow me. In verse 18, it says, immediately they left their nets and they followed him, emphasizing the following again. In verse 9, going on a little farther, he saw James and John, the son of Zebedee. He says he calls to them. And in verse 20, he once again reiterates what they've been called to do. And they followed him. They left everything. They left their nets to follow him. So they've been called to follow on a journey with Christ. Now, everybody's wondering who this Jesus is. I mean, he's so shocking. He comes out of nowhere and everybody's like, who is this guy? And the disciples at once leave everything to go. They want to find out who he is. We find out people questioning all the time in the early chapters of Mark. Verse 27, it says, they were amazed, so they debated among themselves, saying, what is this? A new teaching with authority? These questions continue in chapter 2. Go down to chapter 2, verse 7. After Jesus heals the man paralyzed, forgives the paralyzed man's sins, the Pharisees and scribes in the crowd begin to question, why does this man speak this way? He is blaspheming. Who can forgive sin but God alone? Again, they're wondering about him. Questions continue in 16, verse 16. When the scribes and the Pharisees saw that he was eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners? In verse 18, John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting, and they came to and said to him, why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples don't fast? And finally, another question in verse 24. The Pharisees were saying to him, look, why are you doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath? Everything Jesus does elicits a question. Why are you doing it? Who are you? What gives you this right? So they come up with their own explanations. Chapter 3, verse 22. The scribes who came down from Jerusalem were saying, he is possessed by Beelzebub, and he casts out demons by the ruler of the demons. So they're trying to figure out who he is, so they start coming up with explanations, and obviously they're ultimately wrong explanations. But all the while the scribes and Pharisees are looking unto Jesus, asking questions about him, wondering who he is, the disciples are faithfully walking by his side. And we see in verse 14 of chapter 3, and he appointed 12 so that they would be what? He appointed the 12 so that they would be with him. So it's a call to nearness. To be where he is, to go where he goes, to do what he does. Because again, he says he was going to send them out to preach, to do exactly what he himself was doing. And Jesus, in verse 34 of chapter 3, talks about these people who are around him. When his mother and brothers come to find him or take him away, Jesus looks around to the people who are around him, verse 34. Looking about at those who were sitting around him, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God is my mother and my sister and my brother, my sister and my mother. So these are his family, the people who are near him. His disciples are the ones who are supposed to be by his side, thick as blood, right? So the disciples come and Jesus begins to preach in parables, speak in parables. Now, the parables are often in our modern understanding understood as ways of illustrating Jesus' point or message. That Jesus spoke in parables in order to help us understand what he was talking about. Illustrative sermons, you know. Like Aesop's fables, right? But that's not the reason that Mark gives of why Jesus spoke in parables. In verse 11, we see this. And he was saying to them, verse 10, as soon as he was alone, his followers along with the 12 began asking him about the parables. And he was saying to them, to you has been given the mystery of the kingdom of God, but those who are outside get everything in parables. So he says, you get the mystery, you get the understanding, but I'm giving everybody else this coded language so that they will not understand. Verse 12. So that while seeing, they may see and not perceive, and while hearing, they may hear and not understand, otherwise they might return and be forgiven. This is clandestine communication. This is the Enigma code machine. Jesus does not want the outsiders to understand what he's truly saying, but everything is told privately to the disciples. Verse 13, and he said to them, "Do you not understand this parable? How will you understand all the parables?" And going down to verse 34 of chapter 4, and it says, "He did not speak to them without a parable, but he was explaining everything privately to his own disciples," his followers. And yet, his disciples don't get it. They don't understand. Again, when they ask, when they have to come to Jesus and say, can you explain this parable to us? And he gives them, okay, I'm going to explain this one to you so you can get it. So they go out on the boat immediately after verse 34, 35, on that day when evening came. He said to them, "Let us go over to the other side." So they get in the boat. They're going over and the winds and the waves start kicking up. And boy, it's a doozy. And Jesus is fast asleep. And they get up and they say, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Another question. They're questioning him just like the scribes and the Pharisees did. "Do you not care?" And then when Jesus hushes and calms the storm, in verse 41, they ask another question. They became very much afraid and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" They don't understand who he is either. But yet they're following him to find out who he is, to find out more about him. And so it goes. In chapter 6, Jesus enters his own hometown. It says in verse 6, chapter 6, verse 1, Jesus went out from there and came into his hometown. And, what does it say? And his disciples followed him. Again, they're following close by his side. This word follow continues to appear in Mark's gospel. Now, the rejection at Nazareth is almost like it's a symbolic representation of the entire rejection that Jesus has experienced throughout all of his time in Israel. His hometown is like unto the nation of Israel itself, who ultimately reject him. And so we see in Nazareth a microcosm of what's to come. And from there, we find out the very next thing that happens after this story about the rejection at Nazareth is a story about how what happens to John the Baptist. What happened to John the Baptist? Who was John the Baptist? In this gospel, he is Jesus' mentor. He is the one that ultimately brings Jesus into his ministry. Because it was with John the Baptist that Jesus was baptized and ultimately felt his own calling into the ministry, if we can talk about it in those terms. So John the Baptist in Mark's gospel is the forerunner to Jesus, the person who goes before Jesus. And now here in chapter 6, the very center or pretty close to the center of Mark's gospel, what happens to the forerunner of Jesus? He's killed, beheaded. After John is beheaded, I want to note verse 29. So the forerunner to Jesus is beheaded, and what does John's disciples do in verse 29? That's right. His disciples, John's disciples, continue to follow their master and take care of his body. What do the disciples do in the end of Mark? They run away. John's disciples are bold and brave. They go looking for their master's body and bury it appropriately. But yet, and Jesus' disciples will run away and deny him. Verse 31, Jesus learns about the death of John the Baptist and he asks his disciples to come away. "Come away by yourself to a secluded place and rest a while, for there were many people coming and going." And this is the place that Jesus begins to test his disciples. He knows his time's short. He sees in John the Baptist's death the foreshadowings of his own. And he knows now's the time not for baby steps anymore, but to let the disciples stand on their own two feet. And so they come to him and they say, "Jesus, these people have been with you too long. Send them away." Right? Send them away. And Jesus says, No. You give them something to eat. How can we do that? So Jesus says, "Well, what do you have?" And he does it for them, okay? So he gives an illustration of how they themselves can do it. "Follow in my footsteps, let's do it." So from there, they go out on the boat, and Jesus walks on the water, and they're terrified again because they see him coming, walking on the water. I want to note this, verse 51. Then he got into the boat with them, and the wind stopped, and they were utterly astonished, for they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. Imagine being astonished by Jesus after you just saw him feed 5,000 people. He can do anything. Why be astonished? This is what he is. And yet they're still overwhelmed because they don't get who he is. Because again, Mark says their hearts were hardened. In chapter 7, the Pharisees and scribes show up on the scene again, and they want to come pick on the disciples. In verse 5, the Pharisees and scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat their bread with impure hands?" Again, they want to pick a fight with Jesus' disciples, and Jesus is going to defend them. Calls them whitewashed tombs. "You guys teach the commandments of men." And Jesus says in verse 14, "Listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside the man which can defile him, if it goes into him, but the things which proceed out of the man are what defile the man." Verse 17, "When he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples questioned him about the parable." Let me ask you this. Is it a parable? I think Jesus was pretty clear. What goes into the man doesn't make him unclean. It's what comes out of the man that makes him unclean. It's not a parable. And his disciples ask him, "Well, what are you talking about, Jesus?" And he said to them, "Are you so stupid?" These are pretty harsh language here that Jesus used. And I'm going to say this, that our modern translations sometimes whitewash the language of the scriptures. But here Jesus says, are you so stupid that you don't understand? And he explains it to them. Chapter 8, we come to another situation, much like in chapter 6. Once again, there's a crowd of people. Once again, they've been there too long. Once again, the disciples say, "We must give them something to eat. Turn and send them away." And Jesus once again says, "You give them something to eat." And they say, "How? How can we do this?" This is deja vu all over again. And his disciples answered him, "Where will anyone be able to find enough bread here in this desolate place to satisfy these people?" And Jesus says, "Have them come here. Let's sit down." Well, they get in the boat again to go over to the other side. And when they're getting in the boat, Jesus says, "Beware of the leaven of the scribes and the Pharisees." And in verse 16, "And they began to discuss with one another the fact that they had no bread." It's because we don't have any bread. And Jesus launches out at them. "Why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you yet not undersee or understand? Do you have a hardened heart? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? I fed the 5,000 with a few loaves. I fed the 4,000 with a few loaves. And yet you're concerned about bread." They don't understand it. When Jesus is talking in parables, they don't understand it. When Jesus is talking plainly, they think he's talking in parables. They're stupid. And I'm not being hard on him. Mark's being hard on him, purposely being hard on the disciples. And he makes fun of them, pokes at them, shows them their faults. And here we come to our first question in chapter 8, verse 22. "And they came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to Jesus and implored him to touch him. Taking the blind man by the hand, he brought him out and he spit." And he heals him twice. We don't have to read the story again. And then in verse 27, something breaks. "Jesus went out along with his disciples to the village of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he questioned his disciples, saying to them, 'Who do people say that I am?' And they told him, saying, 'John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, but others one of the prophets.' And he continued by questioning them, 'But who do you say that I am?' Peter answered and said to him, 'You are the Christ.'" They get it, at least in part. "And he warned them not to tell no one about him." In verse 31, Jesus for the first time begins to tell them what's going to happen to him in Jerusalem. And this verse in 27, with Peter's declaration, "You are the Christ," which happens in the very far north of Israel. Caesarea Philippi is one of the farthest points north in Israel. And it's at this place that Peter makes his declaration. And it's this place that Jesus begins his journey to Jerusalem. The way, the path. Up until this time, Jesus has been in Galilee, and all the stories have related to the Sea of Galilee. They're crossing over the sea, they're on the seashore, they're around the sea, all the time. Galilee and the Sea of Galilee is central to the early parts of the disciples' relationship with Christ. And it is this point that Jesus no longer hangs out around Galilee. This time he sets his face towards Jerusalem. And it is in this way, verse 31, that Jesus begins to say, "My direction is towards the cross." And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. Verse 32. And he was stating the matter plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning around and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but man's." They get it. They saw that he's the Christ. But Jesus says, "I'm not the Christ of your expectations." What's the Christ? Who's the Christ in Jewish expectations? He's the one that's going to kick out the Romans, right? He's going to come in with a military ruler riding on a white horse. Everything's going to be glorious when he does battle with the evil ones. But Jesus says, "That's not my way. You know I am the Christ, but not the Christ of your expectations. Not what you were taught that the Christ is meant to be. I'm the Christ who's going to suffer and die." And Peter's like, not going to have it. And again, he's lacking in understanding. He refuses to listen to what Jesus has to say. Over the course of chapters 8 through chapter 10, we're going to see this repeated 3 times. Jesus says, "I'm going to die." The disciples misunderstand what that means. And then Jesus is going to give a paradox, a different wisdom than the wisdom that they're used to. And this paradox is found, the first paradox is found in verse 34. And he summoned the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it." Now, this is not what you think. If you want to save your life, you need to save your life. You don't lose your life in order to save your life. This is a paradox. It doesn't make sense on the rational level. And in verse 34, I want to note this, that he says, if anyone would come and follow me, I'm sorry, if he'd come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. This is the path. This is the way of God. So he sets out on his journey. Verse 31, Jesus says once again, he was teaching his disciples and telling them the Son of Man is to be delivered into the hands of men and they will kill him. And when he has been killed, he will rise 3 days later. This is the second prediction of his death. And in verse 32, we find the misunderstanding. But they did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. I think he's stating it very clearly. And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he began to question them, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. Again, Jesus has just told them, "I'm going to die on the cross. I'm going to Jerusalem to die." And they want to know who's got the better, you know, who's got top listing, billing in Jesus' disciples list. You're all going to die. Who really cares? That's where you're headed. If you're following Jesus, you're going to your death. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. In verse 35, Jesus teaches the paradox. Sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, "If anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and the servant of all." It's that paradox again. Skip down to verse 33 of chapter 10. Here's the third and final time. "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles." Now, this is the most explicit time that Jesus talks about this prediction. It gets more explicit as it goes along. "They will mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him, and 3 days he will rise again." Can't argue with that. verse 35, James and John, the two sons of Zebedee, came to Jesus saying, "Teacher, we wanted you to do for us whatever we ask of you." So they're going to ask, right after Jesus said, "I'm going to die on the cross," they're going to ask to sit on his right and his left in his glory. But Jesus said to them, note what he says in verse 38, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink of the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" What's he talking about here? His death, right, his suffering. "Are you able to do what I am about to do?" And they said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said, "The cup that I drink, you shall drink, and you shall be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized. But to sit on my right and on my left, this is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." Now this is the second question, or this is the fourth question that we asked. Who sits on his right and in his left in his glory? The thieves on the cross. Only two other people are ever mentioned to be on Jesus' right and his left in the Gospel of Mark, or any of the Gospels for that matter. And it's the two thieves that die with him. And this is what Jesus is calling to. So when James and John come to him and say, "Grant that we may sit on your right and your left," Jesus is saying, "You don't know what you're asking for. Are you able to do this?" And they said, "We are able," but Jesus says, "Well, it's going to happen later, but on my right and my left, in my glory." This isn't about heaven, folks. This is about the cross. Mark describes the cross as Christ's coronation. And if you think of the symbolism in the cross, you'll see all the symbolism of a king. The purple robe, the crown of thorns, even the titleless above Jesus' head. This is the King of the Jews. Irony. The people think they're mocking him, but in actuality, this is Jesus' pathway to his coronation. His inauguration. The path, the way of suffering. So Jesus enters Jerusalem triumphantly. Let's go down to chapter 13, skipping over quite a bit. Chapter 13. Jesus rejects Jerusalem. Jerusalem with its religious establishment and all their questions, and they're trying to trap him. Jesus rejects it completely. And in chapter 13, he'll give the second Sermon on the Mount, of what's often referred to in Matthew, or the Olivet Discourse, the prophecy about what's going to take place before the Son of Man's coming. And the direct relationship is that this seems to refer to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. We'll get into that right now. But there is a future fulfillment to this, but there's also a past fulfillment, a generation within the time that Christ died, 40 years after Christ's own crucifixion. But towards the end of this passage, Jesus tells them, "You must stay awake." Verse 35, "Therefore be on the alert, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming, whether in the evening at midnight or when the rooster crows or in the morning. In case he should come suddenly and find you asleep. What I say to you, I say to all, stay awake." Stay awake. What happens in chapter 14? They go out to the Gethsemane. Jesus asks them to pray. And their eyes are so heavy, and they all fall asleep. Jesus had just told them, "Stay awake, stay awake." And yet they fall asleep. So the betrayer comes, Judas with the soldiers. Verse 50, "And they all left him and fled." Note the depressing sadness in that phrase. All the things we've just come through. What is a disciple? Who is a disciple? Someone who follows Jesus. And at this moment, when they're supposed to follow him, when all that he said to them is the fulfillment of all that he's taught them, and they run away. And here in verse 51, we see this young man for the first time. A young man was following him wearing nothing but a linen sheet over his naked body, and they seized him. But he pulled free of the linen sheet and escaped naked. If we think about nakedness in the scripture, we know obviously we can think of the first naked people in the Garden of Eden. What is nakedness but shame? And this man left his calling for his shame. A linen sheet, I want to say this, a linen sheet only appears one other time in the Gospel of Mark. And again, one other time is big in the Gospel of Mark, finding correlations and connections. In chapter 15, verse 46, we see that it's the linen sheet, a linen cloth, which is wrapped around the dead body of Jesus. The linen sheet is a symbol of their calling, of the disciples' calling. They were called to die with him, to be with him, to suffer the same death that he was meant to die. And yet, as soon as that moment came, when they stared death in the face, they ran away and left that sheet behind. And they embraced their nakedness instead. The young man is a symbol of all the disciples. He's not just Mark or any person in particular. Mark tells the story as a symbol of the disciples' own shame. He represents all of them. Obviously, we know the story of Peter's own denial. Mark will go into that. I'm not going to repeat the story of Peter's own denial, but it bears thinking about in terms of what we all just said. That he calls down curses upon himself if he ever knew the man. I did not know him. I never had anything to do with him. But yet in 16, we find the resurrection. Christ has had his coronation. He's entered his kingdom, and he rises from the dead. And we find the women going, not the disciples, we find the women, right? It's not the disciples, they've gone. They're gone somewhere. And the women follow and faithfully follow after Jesus. In verse 5, it says, entering the tomb, they saw an angel. Does it say an angel? Mark calls him what? And who else do we see a young man? Where do we see him? In the garden. Two times. Once at the disciples' betrayal, and now here once again at their restoration. And instead of a linen sheet, what is he wearing? Sitting at the right, wearing a white robe. And this is the person he said to them, do not be amazed. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who has been crucified. He has risen. He is not here. Behold, here is the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you to Galilee, and there you will see him. Just as he told you. Why does Jesus tell them to go back to Galilee? That's where their journey began. He's saying, I want you to start over again. Now, this is forgiveness without saying, I forgive you. He's telling them exactly what to do. Go tell the disciples, I think he says, and Peter, if I'm not mistaken. Peter being the one, the chief one who denied him. I'll go and I'll meet you there. And notice the forgiveness does not entail a negation of all that transpired. Jesus doesn't say, well, forget about it. It's the past. I forgive you. The path begins over again with the destination still the same. Ultimately their own death, that they must follow him and do likewise. The journey is to their own death. And if they follow that journey again towards their own death, they will find him in that journey. So verse 8, they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had gripped them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. The question remains, are we going to go with him to Galilee? Are we going to meet him there? Every time I think about Mark's gospel, and I think about it often as we're worshiping or things like that, I think about my life. Now, this is not a story for young men and women. This is not a story for new converts. This is a story for you and me who've been with Christ so long and have seen the times that we've denied him. Mark's gospel, if we go through and we can talk about the historical situation that it was written, was most likely written between 60 and 70 A.D., a time in 64 AD when the church was persecuted by Nero, being hung up and held up in crosses and burned, put in animal skins and torn apart by wild dogs. And between 70 AD, that ultimate destruction of Jerusalem that we talked about. This is a time of immense persecution. And Mark is writing to the Roman church, more than likely. A Roman church facing so much persecution and saying, hey, you've all denied him. You've all denied him. These people were probably terrified of losing their own life. Many of them probably said, I don't know who you're talking about, and then came to church next week to repent. And Mark's telling a story specifically, purposefully, to tell them your path, your journey is the same one that he took. And until you embrace that, you won't find him. It's only in your death that you'll find him. It's only in your death that you'll meet him. So I think about my life in terms of all the mistakes that I've made. But the forgiveness is there without denying the hard sayings of the gospel. And that's what Mark gives to us. So I think about all the hard sayings in the gospel of Mark. All the things, and you could think about, I don't want to point out all the things that you've done. And you alone know those things that you've done when you lay awake at night and think, man, how I've denied him. Man, how I could have lived up. Man, what I could have been if I'd just done this or that. You could start over again. He goes before you and he waits for you. Let's pray.